This is Talk Is Cheap. I'm your host, DJ Sisti. This week, continuing on with Chris Carlson, who wrote Nowtopia and started the critical mass movement. Second half of an interview that I found on his site. It's Chris Carlson with two S's. And then another short interview that he did. And some other fun surprises. Just a little commentary. In a way, summing up what Carlson talks about is we need to decentralize and localize. And I think they're going to run... I hope the Democrats aren't going to run Hillary Clinton. I think that would be a disaster. Because both parties seem to be the party of corporations. And the example is, for why are we running a wire to a power station when we could have rooftop solar and decentralize the power grid and conserve electricity? Hillary Clinton would be a mistake, also because of the war in Ukraine would continue. Instead of giving reparations to Ukraine and ultimately Russia and bringing Russia into NATO and abolishing NATO. So, we need to decentralize and localize and stop subsidizing multinational corporations. And we need rooftop solar, rooftop solar. Rooftop solar. All right, so coming up, Chris Carlson. Thanks for listening to KPW LP 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio.
How many tens of thousands of other people decided to get out of their car and try bicycling in that, sometime in the last 25 years, because they ran into a traffic jam that was created by bicyclists having a lovely time together, or they saw it on the TV news, or they heard about it from a friend through word of mouth, and they thought, you know, I'd like to try that. Maybe it'll be fun. And then they try it, and they go, oh, I can do this every day. Why don't I ride a bike instead of a car? This is way better. And so that's, I think, a very common experience, and particularly good around, you know, living in patriarchal cultures, because obviously, you know, the domination of the streetscape by men and hostile men who are, you know, sexist pigs is extremely common. And on a bicycle, a lot, isolated women on bicycles can often feel quite threatened out there on the streets. It's really bad, and worse in some cultures than others, but it's pretty bad across the board. And people start gaining confidence when they're in groups and can ride safely in a group and get the protection of the group, that then later when they are alone and they face difficult situations, they have a better idea how to handle themselves and get out of those situations. Essentially, it's a matter of evasion more than confrontation. But I've known women who have taken it upon themselves to pull out their U-locks and get into some pretty severe violent situations with people who are harassing them. So depending on your proclivities, there's, you know, a lot of room for liberation around comportment in the streets. The earliest critical mass experiences in San Francisco, where I live, in 1992 and 93 were not particularly internet related. It just happened before the web had taken off. And of course, social media, the explosion of social media since around 2010 has created its own dynamics of, you know, all sorts of dynamics, many of them terrible, but the ability to connect with people is still true. You can find your like-minded individuals out there who are engaged in those kinds of groups, whether on Facebook or Instagram or any of the other commercial sites. I like the independent, you know, things like this, where you just meet with friends and have a chat and find people that you're want to have some kind of ongoing engagement with and meet out elsewhere, hopefully face to face in a bar or cafe or a public park or who knows what. All that kind of politics goes a lot better. And that's why critical mass has been powerful, is that it's a lot of face to face meetings in practice, in streets, in cities all over the world for years and years. And out of those practical gatherings, which are impractical in the moment, it's like it's just a gathering of people on bikes. Who cares? But people have really over and over again made friends and started new initiatives out of that, whether it's bike related or transit related, or, you know, redesigning city life or creating parklets, for instance. That was originally kind of something that grew out of critical mass, and then it became a global phenomenon to repurpose parking places on streets into little tiny urban parks. So there's a lot of ways that, you know, the need for public space has found its expression and its expansion of its need being met through direct action and political activism that comes out of people meeting each other and going forward. Now, social media groups have their limits, obviously. You can click all day long and nothing will change. But if you take that first click and go further and actually find a way to meet up with people and engage in the real world, well, then it's a very useful starting point. Other people might have other opinions or other stories to tell. Well, level playing field would be probably overstating it, but I do think everybody has some capacity to intervene in their local political dynamics, you know, whether through, I mean, I mentioned earlier that I'm not that oriented around policy or trying to convince professionals to be activists. That doesn't seem to hold a lot of promise to me. But that said, you know, there's the city of San Francisco has a reputation as this super activist place where everything can be done and everything's possible, but that's just not true. I mean, San Francisco is a very conservative place, really. We're way more like the rest of the United States than not. And though we've had a long history of interesting things that happened here, it's all same could be said for New York or, you know, Chicago or New Orleans or whatever. There's other cities in the U.S. that have similar stories. So it's more about kind of figuring out, you know, the sort of milieu that you can engage with creatively and take collective action if there is such a thing in your neighborhood or in your community, in your city. And I think that it does exist everywhere all the time. Like, there's always room to take like an artistic approach and a kind of constructive and invitational approach to political dissent, as opposed to an angry, guilt tripping or, you know, admonishing way. I mean, nobody wants to be guilt tripped. Nobody wants to be, oh, you did everything wrong. You're a bad person because you're eating the wrong food and wearing the wrong clothes and traveling in the wrong way and stop doing all those bad things and start doing good things, you know, like I think you should. Nobody listens to that. Nobody. So, you know, no matter what your politics are. So you have to figure out a way to be like, I actually like to always say pleasure in the sense of enjoyment, full enjoyment. I actually have a fake organization that I had for years called the Committee for Full Enjoyment, not Full Employment. Because most jobs are a waste of time after all. Why bother? You know, let's just get on with doing the work we really need to do, which there's a ton of work that needs to be done, but that's not getting done. And the structure of jobs where we sell our time to a job is exactly the problem, in my opinion. So anyway, I will digress on that quite rapidly, if you let me. But I think that there's room in any space, especially an urban space, to find like-minded people who are bored or tired or frustrated or angry, with whom you can build connections and begin to make changes in your immediate circumstances that makes your life better right away that day, and that begin to envision a more long-term series of transformations that you want to work towards, whether they're transformations amongst, you know, around gender relations or race relations or transportation dynamics and infrastructure or food dynamics and, you know, growing more food locally and having it more healthfully grown with less chemicals. I mean, there's just so many places to intervene. And as soon as you start to intervene, the people who have kept things the way they are, they get nervous, you know, and if they have the forces of law and order and thuggery at their disposal, well, you better take that seriously because, you know, there's many places in the world where you get killed for doing things. That doesn't seem to happen here very much. In that sense, we're privileged for sure. We don't have death squads at our door yet, but I don't think it's impossible that we might not face that in the future. Certainly the people who have been rioting and you know, supporting Trump in the United States are just two or three steps short of becoming death squads. So, you know, it's not really, for most of us, we think that's not far off. You know, that vision of fear and loathing that is that just percolating under the surface, even in this culture. So the privileges of U.S., the bubble in which we live may be short-lived. We'll see. But anyway, I digress. The point is that anybody can do it. And you can do it on a very, start small, start in your immediate life. Think about where you are and what you can do tomorrow that makes it better, whether it's riding your bike to a community garden and having a conversation with a new friend about growing the same food they're growing or learning how to prepare it in a meal and sharing a meal. Or, I mean, obviously COVID puts a crimp in a lot of that stuff, but as soon as COVID's over, we should be able to resume a lot of that sort of creative community building activities that make our lives better. I mean, I want to live well now. I don't want to wait around for some, you know, imaginary revolution that's going to come and make my life better. That's how I'm going to get onto it right away. And for the most part, I have, you know, I haven't been waiting around. I have been living the world, the life I want to live. I don't work very much because I don't believe in doing a lot of stupid work, but I work very hard at what I like to do. And, you know, I'm 64, so I, you know, spent a lot of years manipulating the world around me to suit my needs. And I've achieved a certain level of comfort as a result. And I don't think it's impossible for other people to do that. I think anybody could take that kind of action. But I live on very little money compared to most Americans. I don't have a lot of income. I just have a low cost of living. I have low, cheap rent, and I don't own a car, and I don't have to support anybody else. And it's just easy to live well if that's their circumstances. So I don't know if that's useful. I hope it is. The three-headed monster is real, and the idea of having any kind of sort of low-level, marginal, nowtopian, you know, degrowth project that will supplant them just because you've got a good idea, that's not going to happen, right? We're talking about real power and real force. So displacing and supplanting the three-headed monster, the car and road building being part of that, of course, but, you know, I can imagine a road building world that's not rooted in the car. But car and oil are really tough, and there's a lot of sunk costs there, and there's a lot of people that make a living from those industries. And you know, to begin to address that in a meaningful way, to me, and again, I have to emphasize, I'm extremely marginal. Like, nobody listens to me about this kind of stuff. But my opinion is that we have to rethink work. I've been arguing about this since 1979. Like, this is really the key issue of our lives. is we somehow think that having a society based on the buying and selling of human time, that is wage labor, is perfectly reasonable, and it's always been this way and it'll always be that way. And that's completely false. It's actually very recent that that became the global norm. And there's many parts of the world where it's still not that normal to have to sell yourself for wages. Of course, the whole process of dispossessing people from land so they can't grow food to feed themselves forces them into getting money to pay their bills and blah, 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 blah. We know how it works. But there's no reason to organize life that way. That's just a concession to the powers that be to let them continuing to dominate and enslave us. So to me, if you want to talk about undoing the three-headed monster, you can't talk about it in isolation. You have to talk about the reproduction of life as a whole. And that involves everything that we care about: communications, transportation, food, shelter, love and sex. All these things are in the conversation. You know, racial dynamics that are right front and center every day now. We can't get away from it. That's the world that's gotten created by this three-headed monster and much more. Not just them, but modern food business is one of the great enemies of our quality of life, to put it mildly. The communications infrastructure that's grown up is not serving us. It's serving the surveillance capitalists who are making money off every conversation we have. I mean, Zoom, who the fuck is Zoom? Why are we talking on their software? You know, we should be talking on something else. So it's a much bigger problem. And to have a culture that begins to create a critical dialogue around the stupidity of modern work and the possibilities of a really abundant life that we have a right to and that we can create with the work we do when we get up in the morning and do the work that needs to be done instead of the work that's oppressing us, that seems like a worthwhile goal as part of, you know, the car-free logic, as part of the logic towards a new way of thinking about city life. We have to redo how we produce life. It's the work we do that makes the mess. And so we better stop making a mess, and then we can start talking about making the world as beautiful as it really could be. Yeah, e-bikes are no happy solution. They're better than cars, but that doesn't make them good. Right? That's kind of the weird world we're in. Oh, you know, there's a boom in e-bikes going on here, an absolute boom. And COVID actually exploded it for some curious reason. So I recently got one for my daughter. So she's got two small children, so she can actually schlep the kids around now on the back of the bike. And she's like, God, Dad, how about an e-bike? Because I can't stand driving. I hate being in the car. And I was like, great, let me get you an e-bike. So why not? They're not cheap, though. That's the problem. You have to. It's really hard to find them that you can afford. There is one brand that I found in Portland, Oregon, that was considerably less expensive than others. So, and the quality turns out to be quite good. So. But yeah, the e-bike is like the bicycle itself. You know, I talked about that earlier. The bicycle is an industrial device. Let's not kid ourselves. It's not made out. You know, there are bamboo bikes, I know, but I mean, generally, the bike is not something you can just make in your living room out of natural materials. You know, you need all these industrially produced products, as well as the tools. So, you know, some system of complexity around the production of life will go on. No matter what, if we want to live in dense urban environments with each other and figure it out with each other, we need to figure out how to produce things that take some level of complexity and materials. I do think we could do a lot with the reuse and recycling of almost everything and figuring out how to make everything easy to repair and, you know, easy to use parts that fit with each other and so on and so forth. All these things are doable. But again, it goes to the heart of the question, like, how come we don't have any conversations about that? About how we would restructure the production of every product in our lives. That we would have a conversation about restructuring how we use fresh water day in and day out. There's just not that enough of it on the planet anymore. So we have to recycle all the water. We should be doing that. We should have chemical toilets, you know, where everything composts automatically. Some countries still do, but, you know, the modern model is to have it flushed down the toilet and never see it again. And it goes into a giant processing facility and then is dumped in the ocean. And it's just like, that is so stupid. I can't even believe we're still doing that, but that is the model. So there's a lot of sort of basic infrastructural questions that, you know, are part of this question that I like to raise. Why do we do what we do? Most of what we do, we shouldn't. We should stop tomorrow. We'd be better off. Now, having stopped all that dumb work, what should we do? Well, it turns out there's a ton of work to do, and most of it's not being addressed. And it all has to do with radically altering our relationships to the natural systems in urban environments. We could live in relative harmony and actually get a lot of help from nature if we embarked on a whole permacultural transformation of everyday life. Let's get on with it. It's a lot of work. Well, stop doing all that stupid work and let's start doing that. Sign me up.
KPW 97.3 FM, Eugene Peaceworks Independent Community Radio, streaming online at kpw.org.
Today on the podcast, we are chatting with Chris Carlson, the director of Shaping San Francisco and the co-director of the Archive of San Francisco History at foundsf.org. Chris is a writer, San Francisco historian, tour guide, blogger, and he recently published his new book, Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes, and Radical Histories.
Well, thank you for being on the podcast today, Chris. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you. Happy to be there.
You've been doing this a very long time. And by this, I mean Shaping San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I was kind of reading through your intro of the book. And I have to say, my brain was tickled seeing mention of the initial Shaping San Francisco concept, which I guess was a game on CD-ROM. Yeah. Which was a thing, like a word that, or I guess a word that I haven't seen in about 20 something years. Yeah. So, you know, and we thought we've been at this for a while. So it looks like you've depended on different technologies of the times to help you in this endeavor over these many years. But what led you to a good old fashioned book?
Well, I'm a book person. I'm a print media guy. My background is that I was in the mid-70s when I came of age. My first jobs, one of the earliest jobs I got was a temporary word processor. So I was always involved. And my very earliest skill that I developed that I was able to make a living from selling was typing. There had been offset printing available, and there had been actual typesetting available. But those skills were not insignificant. You had to know how to operate a machine that cost, you know, upwards of $50,000 to $100,000 to do typesetting that came out on photographic paper. Ultimately, that's how I made a living. I have this long history with technologies of print media and print production mm-hmm. that precede the desktop computer. And I came of age into that world. And I was also learning word processing on Mag Card 2, you know, the material that was used to be inside of diskettes when we had diskettes.
That's right. I know another fun word. Like yeah. We're just throwing in all of our old school technology words. Yeah, CD-ROM, diskette. Too. Yeah.
And actually my Muni story during that time, because I know you were looking for Muni diaries.
Yeah, tell us your Muni story. Well, I know you've got one.
They raised the price from 50 cents to 65 cents back in around 1980 or 81, I think it was. Or maybe it was it would have been about 81 or 82. And we were by then had started our magazine, our underground magazine called Processed World, which we did for 13 years throughout that time in the financial district. And we were out there dancing around in strange costumes, selling magazines every Friday at lunch. But we were always looking for ways to intervene in everyday life in San Francisco. And one thing, when the Muni Fair came along, we had this whole campaign. You probably won't remember because you weren't around then, but there was a series of billboards that Dianne Feinstein put up that said, no fair is no fair, trying to like basically guilt trip.
That's pretty good. Lines. I'm a word person myself. I do think that's a good one.
And so we just went around and did, you know, billboard alterations to take out the second no. And so no fair is fair. And then we put a big picture of Dianne Feinstein in the middle of it and had all the angry cartoon characters who were berating the scofflaw fair evader in the billboard suddenly became Dianne Feinstein in the middle.
Oh, okay. Who a little bit reimagined.
Yeah. And so for about two or three mornings, 1 week after much preparation, and we didn't really carry it off for very long, but we basically dressed ourselves in drag as Diane and the Fine Stylistics. And we got on the Muni.
Do you have pictures of this?
No, happily no.
I was going to say, I mean, pictures or it didn't happen.
Yeah, no, but we would get on the Muni and at this either the N Judah or the 7 Hate, because we were living in the Hate at the time. And we would start doing, stop in the name of the law before you go too far, and do this whole sort of silly song thing. But people, it was impossible. It was, you know, rush hour and crowded, and everybody was like, what are you doing? Get the hell off the bus. We're trying to get to work. So it was
kind of like the Muni we all know and love, really.
Yeah, you never know what's going to show up. Exactly. So we were part of that for a little while. But yeah, in that era, we were very busily trying to overthrow capitalism at the point of circulation. And that was, mm-hmm. Everybody working in the financial district had a pretty clear stake in participating in that process. And, you know, we knew that not everybody would be enthused about such a concept, but there would always be some people in every workplace that were. And we tended to identify each other and find each other with what we called the bad attitude. You could always find the person that you're probably going to be allied with by figuring out who has a bad attitude about this place. And so we were wearing funny costumes like VDT heads that said things like IBM, intensely boring machines, and GM, general monotony. And they had these Mylar screens over them so you couldn't see who we were, right? But we would be yelling. You could hear us perfectly well. And we'd be holding up magazines and say, if you hate your job, you'll love this magazine. Check it out right here, Process World, dollar copy. And we'd always have one calm person, preferably female, at the table with all of magazines laid out on the table. So if somebody could come up and have a perfectly calm conversation with a reasonable person that was unthreatening, while the loudmouths were in these weird costumes sort of floating around in circles, you know, sort of out of the periphery, yelling and catching attention.
Yeah, you guys were the megaphone for the project.
Yeah. And so that went on for, you know, many, many years, and we had a lot of fun doing that. It was a way of creating public space, really. You know, it was one of the ways that started my own brain thinking a lot more about public space. You know, there's things like Crocker Plaza and the corner of Sansomon Market and Sutter, where there was these sort of empty spaces that hardly anybody used. And we thought, well, we should use these spaces and create, you know, this new kind of way of occupying the space and advertising that we want people to get together. And so we ended up meeting at bars, Specs Bar in North Beach, for several years on Wednesday nights. And it got big for a little while, but people were really looking for answers, and we didn't have answers. Finally, when you're doing political organizing, people want sort of simple answers, or simpler answers than just saying, oh, it's very complicated. We want to change how we produce life in toto. Like, it's not enough to just talk about getting more wages or getting respect for your work or the kind of things that the typical white collar organizers were talking about. It was like, no, we don't care about that at all. We want to actually overthrow the stupidity of modern life and start addressing the issues that we actually face, which are.
It sounds like that kind of that philosophy, and that was really kind of what both brought you to San Francisco and kept you here. Is that accurate? And if it's not, then kind of what's your story with kind of social activism and coming to San Francisco?
I moved to San Francisco on the 1st of January, 1978, because I saw an ad in the paper and I wanted to move. I'd already been coming to San Francisco on a regular basis. And I just said, fuck it, move to San Francisco. That's where I want to be. Yeah. So I moved into Haight-Ashbury, 540 Cole Street, right off of the corner of Haight-Ashbury. The Straight Theater was still across the street at that time with a Viet Cong flag on the side of it, although it hadn't been used for a while. And Haight Street was 50% boarded up. It was a complete slum, and it was full of alcohol and heroin and just bad stuff. But I was, you know, for me, that was kind of familiar. I'd been living and growing up in Chicago and Oakland, so it didn't feel unfamiliar. It was a half black neighborhood still that time too. The Lower Haight was not the Lower Haight. It was the Fillmore. It was still black. And all of Page Street from Golden Gate Park all the way to Market Street was owned by African Americans.
Okay. I mean,
that was who lived there. That just had been there for already a couple of decades. And so that was at the tail end of the period of time in which you had weird conflicts between, you know, communes of white hippies fighting with their black landlords, which is one of the weird bits of history that I learned about around the Haight-Ashbury and the whole hippie time.
Interesting.
But I came in at the end of that. I came in 78. And so I was there. I got to San Francisco, and then I decided after 6 months of canvassing for Citizens for a Better Environment, which just opened its offices here, it was a very radicalizing experience. And I went going door to door all over the Bay Area, pretty much every neighborhood in the greater Bay Area over the 6 month period.
I would love to know what you like knitting them together. What would you say are the top lessons from the past, from your personal past, that you think that we could apply to the current times or the future? Because you're talking a lot about things that happened in the past, but they all are obviously still very relevant today. So in the course of you just being Chris, and also you in the course of, you know, putting this book together and these shared histories, like, what are the top lessons you think? Like,
well, I mean, one lesson, that the biggest one, I guess, if you're going to try to make a list like that, would be to combat amnesia. You know, that's what I learned doing all those things. I mean, I mentioned Process World, and we've been out in the streets for a decade and up to the early 1990s. And one of the common experiences doing that, similar to what had happened to me going door to door in the late 70s, was that people didn't understand anything about how the world got to be the way it was. They just assumed it had always been this way, whatever the moment was, and that it would always be that way, that there was no changing it, you know, sort of fatalistic attitude. And the more you understand of history, and especially the contestation over history that this my book, Hidden San Francisco, tries to really help uncover, at least for the city of San Francisco, the more you realize that there are constant moments of possibility, constant moments where things could go in one direction or another. And you never can be quite sure. I mean, obviously there's the weight of power and concentrated wealth and capital that really has had the upper hand in most of these moments of contestation and has mostly won. But that said, there are so many ways that things are better today than they might have been otherwise if it were not for the contestations that did happen. I mean, easy cases in point are the anti-nuclear movement that I've already referred to, the freeway revolt in San Francisco, which saved most every neighborhood that we like, whether it's the Haight or the Sunset or the Mission District or, you know, or the waterfront. All of these things were going to be destroyed by elevated 8-lane freeways, and they weren't.
Right.
And they weren't largely because of middle-class women who organized themselves and said, no, not places for, to have normal neighborhood lives and not this monstrosity that the engineers think are somehow inevitable and necessary. And then the other obvious one is the Save the Bay movement. Like today, we all take pleasure in going down to the waterfront and taking a walk along the shore. And, you know, that waterfront wasn't always referred to as the waterfront. Of course, it was for a very long time known as the city front because people first encountered it from the water as they came in by ship. But as that became obsolete and people arrived by car and plane and train, the waterfront took on its current demeanor more. And then, of course, post-industrial San Francisco decided this was going to be a great boon for tourism, and that has been. But the access to it, the making it into public space again, has been a public fight. And it was the first effort in the early 60s to Save the Bay movement that really set that in motion, and we've been benefiting from it ever since. So all these are just three simple examples of things that have radically improved life in the Bay Area. There are countless other ones, you know, whether it's the regional park movement of the 30s that created the incredible chain of parks throughout the East Bay, or the efforts to open and preserve wetlands in the South Bay over the last decades. I mean, there's just a lot of things to talk about around all that stuff. And, you know, the labor movement, a complicated piece of that whole story, because in some ways there's a history that gets fairly glorified about the militant labor working class movements in San Francisco, especially in the 30s when we had a general strike, and in 1946 there was a general strike in Oakland. But the sort of co-optation of labor into the capitalist growth agenda during the 50s and 60s is quite profound, and they've never really recovered. And if you go, you have to go even further back into the 19th century to see how the logic of trade unionism put workers on a path towards integration into the capitalist agenda rather than trying to create an alternative agenda. But that's where I kind of reconnect to a much longer history, which is that, you know, there's a history of revolt against work, a history of revolt against, you know, the logic of capital being the determinant of our to decide what to do. We should be able to get up every day and decide what to do and how to do it. Why not? Imagine how good life could be if we actually participated every day in deciding what's worth doing, and had a way of that mechanism built into our everyday lives to participate in that level of self-control and self-imagination and self-determination. But we rarely talk about it at all, let alone do anything to bring it about. And so that's been kind of my life's work. And when you think about like major lessons learned, amnesia being the top of the list, I'd say, you know, try to combat that so that you don't have a sense of permanence about any given moment or time in history. And then the possibility of that organizing and grassroots movements can actually shape in important ways, that's something that's also lost. Where is the agency of history? Who are the agents of history? Well, guess what? We're actually making history right now, having this conversation. I mean, the most simplest act that we engage in is history. And we tend to not think that way because we've been encouraged not to think by, you know, historians for one, and also the sort of the way modern social science has developed and been balkanized into all these specialized categories. I'm a much more of a generalist. I'm in favor of a more generalist attitude towards everything. And I think, you know, everybody has something to contribute. And, you know, while I'm not hostile to expertise across the board, I think there is ways in which people tend to sort of give too much emphasis the expert to tell us what to do or what to think, where many things aren't really subject to that kind of expertise. You know, we're all experts at living, or should be,
Yeah.
If we're not, we should get better at it.
And I'm thinking that probably, that comes through in these tours that you outline in the book. Yeah. And so I wanted to ask, just kind of, especially kind of in the context of the pandemic we find ourselves in, how have you kind of adapted these tours to really not only like keep people, you know, out engaged, but kind of keep knowledge alive, like to keep these histories alive? How has your approach changed over the course of the pandemic?
Well, the first thing we did was we took all of our programming outdoors that wasn't already, which was our primarily our public talk series, which has been a big part of our work for the last, since 2006. We've had a steady ongoing series of public talks at one location or another. And we turned that into what we call the Urban Forum Walk and Talk, which is kind of a much more informal approach to picking a kind of a small geographic place to visit, whether it's McLaren Park or the India Basin shoreline, or we just did Bernal Heights the other week, a couple weeks ago. And then we invite a one or two or three local people that we know, neighborhood folks, to come and talk about what's happening sort of from a political and planning point of view for their neighborhood or their park or what have you. And that's been incredibly fun because it's super informal. Like there's not really a formal presentation moment, but there's a lot of brief moments of presenting during those walks and talks. And so, and then people can chat with each other along the way. And of course, everybody's masked up and doing their social distancing and being careful. And we can only take 12 people at a time. So we have to limit it, which oddly enough led to us having way more demand for our stuff.
Yeah. Not more intimate groups.
Yeah. And also, but you know, we have all these bike tours and walking tours going back for years. And for, you know, a certain bunch of years there, it was getting harder and harder to attract a critical mass of people. Like just wasn't that many people coming to these things anymore. Maybe we'd get 5 or 6 people show up. And it's because they were kind of always available and they're relatively unlimited. And there was no urgency to sign up for them unless you just felt like doing that on a given weekend. And now that they're scarce by government decree, you can only take 12 people per time. Mm-hmm. People, as soon as we announce them, they're completely oversubscribed. And we have waiting lists. So it's curious how that happened. And then that's the other wonderful thing, the other part of your question is sort of, you know, keeping a certain approach to history alive. That's what these public events have always done, is essentially take you into public locations throughout the city and peel back the layers that are kind of invisible to most people until somebody points it out to you. But you can find, you know, like for instance, ghosts of transit lines pass through the Mission District. There's these weird diagonal property lines in a bunch of spots, which is exactly where there used to be a San Jose, San Francisco train line ran.
You'll see them in Potrero Hill as well. Yeah, yep.
Western Pacific that goes right under
that's
there.
That's right. Yeah. So we just wanted to make sure we had enough time to play kind of this lightning round that we do sometimes with our guests. And okay. So we're going to be just tossing you these questions one after another. They're not hard questions, hopefully. So you're therefore allowed one sentence to answer them. And so don't think too hard. And then we'll move on to the next one, just to kind of get to know you in lightning format.
Okay. Sounds like fun.
Yeah. So what best decade in San Francisco?
You need a quick answer. I don't know. I would guess.
Time's up. You know, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, no, time's up. Probably 1700 to 1710.
Yeah, that's oddly specific. Like, I mean, I'm breaking now practice from the lightning round, but why that one?
Well, I'm kind of in the romantic vision of like, where would I want to go more than any other decade in the whole history of San Francisco? I'd like to go to way before the Spanish arrived and see what it would be like. I don't know if I'd want to spend 10 whole years here then, but you know, every decade I can think of all these caveats why that's pretty horrible, you know, as well as being interesting. I mean, everything's interesting. So I'd go to any decade and say that was interesting.
Yeah.
But most of the ones I lived through, I wouldn't choose. So I wouldn't take anything after 1978 because I've been here during those times and they're just not enough interest to me to go back to something I've already lived through. But I'd be very curious. My proposal to the Arts Commission was to do a new book covering the period of time from 1957 to 67. And I would be very interested to come here in 1959, 1960 and sort of experience the dying of the old San Francisco and the emergence of the new one, which was just really taking off during that time.
That's a good way to put that. I might agree with you on that decade myself. So how about favorite San Francisco authors, or we can expand it to the Bay Area if you can't limit it to San Francisco.
Well, one of my favorite authors lives in Davis, Kim Stanley.
Oh, I went to Davis.
Yeah, that's close enough. School. I think we can attach that to our larger metropolitan region. Rebecca Solnit's a good friend of mine, and she's a very brilliant writer. I like some of her books much more than others. My favorite one of hers is The Rivers of Shadow about Edward Muybridge, which is a great history of the role of Muybridge and Stanford and sort of the giving birth to both the high-tech Silicon Valley and the high-tech Hollywood. Both of them have their points of origin here in the Bay Area. So Gray Brecken's a great local writer, wrote Imperial San Francisco. Dick Walker's an incredible political economist and geographer and historian of the Bay Area. So he's definitely one of my go-to guys and favorite writers of the Bay Area.
Great.
I have a lot of fiction writers that I like too, but I'm not sure where they live. So I'd have to run through the list and have you checking the database to see where they live. So
Right. We're not sure that they might qualify, but no, yeah, let's, yeah. That all sounds great. Yeah, no, we are big fans of Rebecca Solnit ourselves. Favorite San Francisco bar?
Well, I'm not a bar guy. I don't mind going to bars once in a blue moon, but I like Martini's if I'm going to go to a bar because it's quiet. And that's to me the key to a bar because I can't hear very well anymore. And when I go into a loud place, whether it's a restaurant or bar, I find it mind-boggling how they've let these places become so loud.
Like, oh yeah, I don't like a loud bar either, and I don't like to linger in a bar where I don't. I mean, now we don't do that, but I never wanted to be in a bar where I couldn't find a seat. You know, that was kind of the criteria for me. I
want to be able to talk. I mean, I want to be able to talk to the people I'm with, and not just the person I'm yelling in their ear. That's not interesting to me. And so, in general, I avoid bars like the plague because they're almost always unbelievably loud and unfriendly places for conversation.
Absolutely.
Oh, Specs. Actually, Specs is still an old favorite of a bar.
Specs is a classic. It's a good place to talk. And so what about your favorite neighborhood in San Francisco to walk in or be in? What's just your favorite San Francisco neighborhood?
Oh, the Mission.
Mission.
I left it briefly when I broke up with my ex, the mother of my daughter, back in 98. And I moved to North Beach and thought maybe that was going to be where I would feel more at home. And I liked being in North Beach when I was there.
Yeah, it kind of seems like it would fit your vibe.
Yeah, but I found it to be kind of a little bit far away from the city. Like it's distant from what I consider to be San Francisco. Actually, when I got over there, I felt really like cut off. And so I was constantly coming back to the center of the city. And then one day I was in the Galleria de la Raza and I saw John Leaños, an old friend, and we got into this chat. And I was like, why am I not living here? This is my home. I live in the Mission. This is stupid. So then I moved back. And then, of course, now I live in a land trusted building on Folsom between 24th and 25th. So I'm very permanent resident of the Mission at this point. I will never leave.
And just one last one. What's your favorite? Of course, you know, we also touched on Muni a little bit, but what's your favorite Muni line or what had been, if you're not taking Muni right now, a number of people aren't?
I think it's a 33 just because of the scenic pleasure of it, taking it from the Mission. And then
that's a great view. Yeah.
I mean, everybody loves the switchback. I've always enjoyed the switchback. I walk by there a lot, but, when I think about a bus ride, that's memorable. You know, that's on the list. The 37 is also on the list for some of the same view reasons.
Well, you know, I want to just kind of make sure that we get like a little plug in for the book. And so if you could just kind of just give your 10-second pitch and name the title of the book and why people should read it.
Yeah. Hidden San Francisco, A Guide to Lost Landscapes, Unsung Heroes and Radical Histories is a collection of stories that I've developed over the years that are essentially the parts of San Francisco history that you are not familiar with, things that are really kind of exciting and interlocking with each other, having to do with four major themes, ecology, labor, transportation, and dissent, broadly understood. So there's a whole lot of examples of these things. There's bike tours that you can take, the maps for those. There's a bunch of walking tours you can take as well. And there's in each chapter, there's an essay that sort of introduces you to the topic of those four big themes. And then it followed with 20 stops, which are essentially page and a half to 2-page accounts of some of these lost histories that I was mentioning earlier, where you go to the location and peel back the history. So it's all there. There's a good index. You can go through the bibliography and figure out all the books you want, always meant to read.
Absolutely. I will confirm that it is the one-stop shop. It's got like a great index, and you can just kind of look up whatever topic you might be interested in which is kind of what I'm doing right now. But yeah, we're just really excited to have you on the podcast. Want to thank you again for joining us and sharing your stories and your perspective. And I hope everybody goes out and gets the book.
Thank you so much. It was delightful to be with you. I'm sorry I ended up spending so much time on my ancient past. But
no, I mean, just this was your time, and we wanted to get to know Chris, and I think we did a little bit. So
I think you did, yeah, more than you wanted to.
Well, thank you again for being on the podcast, Chris. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. Had a great time.
That was Chris Carlson in conversation with Muni Diaries co-founder Tara Ramrup.
That was such a fun conversation, Peter. Chris is such a walking encyclopedia of San Francisco history. And my favorite thing in this interview is when he said that the most important lesson is to, quote, combat amnesia.